Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. Or the times they are a-changing.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGiulio here on 720 WGN. How's it going? We're live in the Skyline studio. After midnight, it'll be two for Tuesday, so get your requests in now. One artist, two songs, 312-981-7200. That, of course, was Bob Dylan. Obviously one of the most politically conscious songwriter singers ever, and mentioned in this book, and the book is called Music is Power: Popular Songs, Social Justice, and the Will to Change, and it's by Brad Schreiber. A terrific, terrific book about protest songs, politically conscious songs, and it's set up beautifully, chronologically, chapter by chapter. It takes you on a journey, and we want to welcome Brad to the show. Brad, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be with you again, Nick. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure, really. Tell everybody about yourself, how you started writing and all that stuff.
Yes, well, before I do that, I want to say that I've been watching WGN streaming, and I want to compliment you on your highly patriotic-looking T-shirt. What is that? It looks like the American flag in the shape of a hammer and sickle, Nick. What is that?
It's the American flag in the shape of the Chicago Cubs logo.
Oh, perfect.
That's what it is.
There you go. See, you turn sideways. This is radio. You have to face me. Wait a minute. That doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't. But yeah.
Oh, there we go.
There it is. All right.
Beautiful.
I don't know. All right.
Yeah. Red, white, and blue Cubbies. Okay.
So, there it is. Well, anyway, welcome back. Tell everybody about your background, Brad.
Well, thank you very much for bringing me back. I loved talking with you about Stop the Show and trading theatrical disaster stories last time I was on.
Yeah, it's such a great
book.
That
was so fun.
Yeah, it was a blast.
Well, I've kind of done everything, Nick. You know, I did theater in the Bay Area with Sam Shepard, and I came down to Los Angeles, sold my soul to the devil, and worked in advertising and television, and I've had a movie made, an animated movie, but it's books that really move me the most, and the books have been wildly varied, from a book about the history of the Los Angeles coroner called Death in Paradise, which I turned into a TV show called North Mission Road, to, well, I guess the best segue, Nick, is the last two books really are the reason I'm now doing Music is Power. 10 years ago, it's the 10th anniversary of my writing Becoming Jimi Hendrix, which was the early years of Jimi that I took from the research of a Hendrix historian named Steve Roby. And then 3 years ago, I wrote a book called Revolution's End, which is about the origins of the Symbionese Liberation Army, which in the 70s kidnapped Patty Hearst. And that's all people knew about it. Well, it turns out Ronald Reagan, governor of California, and the CIA and the prisons created a phony left-wing radical group in order to destroy the credibility of the Black Panthers and the New Left in California. So you've got Jimi Hendrix music, and then you've got the CIA and the FBI and the Black Panthers, and you mix it all together, and you get Music is Power, which just came out from Rutgers University Press.
And it seems like a perfect segue, Brad.
Yeah, and I wanted to do this for a while. The weird thing is, Nick, I wanted to do this book and started on a book proposal before Trump got elected. Of course, you know, if you're truly a radical, you don't believe he did get elected. He lost by 3 million votes. But let's not worry about that.
Right.
So then when Trump took office, I thought, well, this is it. This has to be the next book I do, because we're going to need everything we can to regain what American democracy has lost in the last 3 years. And it's not only to teach people who didn't live in the 60s what was happening then, it's here's the stuff going on now, you know, with Kendrick Lamar, you know, with Lady Gaga talking about Trayvon Martin being shot. We need more musical artists, Nick, to take the responsibility to fight with their labels and say, no, I have to do this song. I know it's political and it may not sell as much as a love song, but we need to involve more people in gaining social justice. And one of the most powerful ways of doing that is through music, because it works on people in an entirely different way from somebody going up on your TV and giving you a stump speech. Mm-hmm. Music is magical in the way it motivates people.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And, you know, in times of social and political discourse, it always seems to me, you know, in my lifetime at least, and I think even before my lifetime, whenever there is political discourse, or the art gets better. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
We might be living in hard times, but the art gets better. I've always felt that way, and not just music, which we're talking about tonight, but, you know, movies and books and mm-hmm. things like that. It's just for some reason, and I think it's because people want to make a statement, and they want to get it out there. Some reason the art gets better during discourse. That's always been my experience.
I agree with you, and as a guy who is very interested in politics, I'm just, I'm happier. Actually, it's ironic. I'm miserable because of what's happening to the country, and yet what's going on in the arts and theater and film and television and, of course, music is more socially aware.
Yeah.
So that's a reflection of what we're going through.
Yeah.
And we have to solve problems, and we have to reach out. We have to be civil. We have to make sure that everyone is represented in this country. And there's been a lot of racism and sexism that have been represented by our supposed leader. And we have to fight that. We have to regain that, because that's one of the beauties of democracy.
Well, let's talk about the book. Let's go back right to the beginning. First of all, tell me a little bit about the way you structured it. You did want to take us on a journey, in a chronological journey, going back to the beginning of protest and politically conscious songs, correct?
Absolutely, Nick, but I also didn't want this book to seem like, oh, Brad, he's got gray in his beard, and he's living the 60s all over again. Let's get rid of this guy. I wanted to choose music from every single genre. So it's both chronological, as you noted, and it's also got a bit of everything. It's got psychedelia. It's got country. Who knew that there was, like, country music that was politically conscious? Of course, hip-hop, comedy. We've got the Smothers Brothers and Tom Lehrer. Then we got, metal.
Mm-hmm.
We've got everything I could think of in there, except perhaps classical music.
Right. Well, let's go with the beginning here. The first chapter in the book, outside of the introduction, is the musical workers of the world, which include Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger and Joe Hill. Tell me about those guys, and tell me about the research you did for these guys. Everybody knows who these guys are. They're legendary.
Well, you know, Joe Hill, you know, of course, Joan Baez, you know, sang that beautiful song, I Dreamed I Saw Joe Hill Last Night. Well, he came from Sweden to the United States, and he was a labor organizer who was falsely accused of a murder in Utah. And he was executed despite protests not only in the United States around the early 1910s. There was outcry in Europe that this guy should not be executed, and he was. And his famous phrase was, don't mourn, organize.
Mm.
So he's kind of, for me, the place to start in terms of politically conscious music. And of course, Woody Guthrie, who has so many wonderful songs. But I tell you something, talking with you here in Los Angeles, Woody Guthrie's songs about the immigrants coming into California and being turned away at the border by the state of California, it just resonates so clearly with the mass exodus of immigrants everywhere. You know, obviously, Trump keeps talking about building a wall, but you got to remember there are millions of people who are being displaced around the world right now due to war and due to leaders who are nationalists and are fomenting hate. So Woody Guthrie, you know, in the 30s, was talking about music that still is applicable today.
Yeah.
And from him, of course, came the great Pete Seeger, the folk artist. And the other thing I would say is, you know, who adored Woody Guthrie? Well, the guy you opened your show with, right. Bob Dylan.
That's right.
He went and saw Woody Guthrie, who was dying in a Long Island hospital. That's how much he worshipped his music.
Mm-hmm. And
he actually met and said goodbye to Guthrie just weeks before he died.
Wow.
And then, of course, Dylan was off to Greenwich Village.
Yeah, and then everything changed. It's remarkable. But it's remarkable how Woody Guthrie's music resonates today, as you were just saying. I mean, it's absolutely true. And that's a thing about a lot of the artists and a lot of the songs that are discussed in your book, is how much they actually still matter. Like, they're still relevant.
The circumstances, Nick, may have changed with Woody Guthrie's song Do Re Mi. By the way, the great thing of talking to you on the air is I can recite lyrics. When I was doing this book for Rutgers, they said, "We're afraid of being sued. You can't print the lyrics." But, you know, Do Re Mi. If you ain't got the Do Re Mi, boys, you ain't got the Do Re Mi. Mm-hmm. Then you better go back to beautiful Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Georgia, Tennessee.
Yeah.
So all those people who were devastated by poverty and the Dust Bowl are coming to California, and unfortunately they were often turned away, and they lived in huge encampments, which we would call homeless encampments today. They were called Hoovervilles,
right?
Because Herbert Hoover was the president, and the conditions there, well, they were not very different from, say, a displacement camp or a camp in Syria. And so Woody was a very important guy, and Pete Seeger carried on the banner, you know, with the Weavers.
Yeah.
And then, of course, his association with the Communist Party ruined his career, basically. The Weavers broke up, and of all people, you probably know this, who's the guy who bailed out Pete Seeger more than a decade after he was blacklisted and got him back on TV? Do you know?
Was it Tom Smothers?
Very well done. The Smothers Brothers, ladies and gentlemen. Obviously, Nick was kind enough to read my book, but I think that's insane.
Well, what's funny is that people, I don't know if people really remember just how political they were. And they got in trouble with CBS for some of the stuff that they did. They spoke out against the Vietnam War. A lot of people think, oh, Smothers Brothers, oh, Dick and Tommy, haha, Mom always liked you better, you know, that kind of stuff.
Right.
But they cared about what was happening in the world, and they were very political.
Yeah, and Tom especially liked to confront CBS executives and push the envelope, as it were. And one of the things I actually kind of drilled down and discovered myself in writing this chapter in Music is Power is that the key to it all was not only that Tom Smothers was kind of a confrontational guy and liked to mix it up, but the Smothers Brothers were a summer replacement show.
Mm-hmm.
So CBS went, yeah, we'll get these two funny folk singers from San Francisco, been at the Hungry Eye, and we'll throw them on for 3 months, and they'll have terrible ratings, and then we'll go back to our regular programming. Well, it became the number one show in America.
Right.
And what happened was CBS said, oh, fine, you want control of the content, whatever's on the show is fine with us. You don't have to check with us, because they thought they'd be gone in 90 days.
Right, right.
And then you have this big war and eventually a lawsuit because they were so political.
Yeah.
They had Harry Belafonte. Oh, here's a great Chicago connection story.
Yeah.
Harry Belafonte is singing a Calypso song about Don't Stop the Carnival, and they're showing him singing it over images of the police in their blue helmets going crazy in Grant Park at the convention in 68. That's the kind of cutting stuff that drove CBS nuts.
Yeah, and there's also the classic appearance by The Who Where they blew up the Keith Moon blew up the entire drum set, and
yeah,
and that happened on the Smothers Brothers show too.
Yeah, well, The Who has a chapter as well, yeah. And I'm fascinated by them. You know, Pete Townsend had gone to an art college. I think it was called Ealing College of Art in London. And he studied with a guy who's very crazy, outrageous professor who's talking about auto-destruction in creating art. Like, you would paint something and then you'd rip it apart or burn it.
Mm.
So, you know, it was by accident that Pete Townsend snapped off the top of his guitar neck in 1964 in a small place called the Railway Tavern in London.
Mm-hmm.
And his managers, they had just taken over The Who, and Townsend reacted perfectly. He snapped off the top of the guitar, and he just threw the guitar down and picked up his 12-string and continued with the song.
Yeah.
And the crowd went crazy.
And that was that became his trademark then. Brad, we got to take Brad, hang on, okay?
Yeah.
We have to take a commercial break. Brad Schreiber is with us. He's the author of a terrific new book called Music is Power, Popular Songs, Social Justice, and the Will to Change. And we'll talk more about politically conscious and protest music after this on WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Skyline studio here until 4 a.m. Coming up after midnight, Margaret Hicks is going to join us. She runs Chicago Elevated Walking Tours. She does these great walking tours of downtown Chicago and just really wonderful stuff. The Pedway Tour, all kinds of really cool stuff. You can check out ChicagoElevated.com. She's going to join us to talk about her latest tours and all kinds of other really cool stuff. Golden Globe nominations were announced. We'll talk about that and shocking moments from the Golden Globes and much more. The Ghostbusters Afterlife trailer came out, and we'll talk about that weirdness and the great franchises that lost it in the end. Right now, though, we are talking about music and the power of music and how over the years music became politically charged and protest music, and the history of this is all put down in this book called Music is Power, Popular Songs, Social Justice, and the Will to Change. And it's about these artists that made a difference in terms of how they were feeling, you know, how personally they were feeling and, you know, doing political music and more than that. So if you want to jump in here, it's 312-981-7200. Brad Schreiber is our guest. Brad, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Nick. I'm afraid I was babbling on and on about Pete Townsend breaking his guitar and his new manager, Kit Lambert, going, I noticed that you broke your guitar. And Townsend said, it was an accident. And Lambert said, I love it. Keep it in. Keep it in the act.
Yeah.
And so, of course, they became famous for smashing their instruments.
Yeah.
But really, it was the Mods and Rockers, just to finish with The Who.
Yeah.
It was the Mods and Rockers in the mid-60s in London, and the sense of disaffiliation, and that's kind of what started off The Who, writing songs about alienation and young people not fitting in.
Yeah.
You know, there was a guy named Stuttering Jack who said, you got to write the songs because you're explaining it for us. So what happened? They wrote I Can't Explain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, issues in Tommy, issues in Quadrophenia, all go back to the mid-60s. And these kids who felt that nobody cared about them and they needed a group like The Who to represent their voicelessness.
You know, it's amazing how, I will say this, Brad, every teenage boy goes through a big Who phase. That's just the way it is. You're like 14 years old. When you discover The Who, it's life-changing if you're a 14-year-old boy. It's because of what you were talking about. They speak to that alienation. They speak to what it's like to be an outsider. But they're a great band. You know, in the same chapter, mm-hmm. you mentioned Black Sabbath, which is one of my favorite bands.
Oh,
man, I love Black Sabbath. They're one of my favorite bands ever. And I don't think they get enough credit for writing some of the politically charged stuff and the protest stuff that they've written.
Yeah, you know, and it was very atypical in a way, not to diss Ozzy Osbourne and the guys, but War Pigs, which has been considered for many years one of the greatest metal songs of all time, mm-hmm. was almost accidental. They wanted to call the song Walpurgis because it was a dark pagan holiday, and they thought it smacked of Satanism, and they said, no, you can't talk about Walpurgis. So they went, okay, well, let's just say, call it War Pigs. Mm. And then they did this incredible song with what I refer to as crunchy guitar that you have got to love with Tommy Iommi. And, of course, they equate the generals, the military, with the satanic, mm-hmm. which was a huge connection because, for my money, Nick, one of the things that metal has missed is the ability to talk about what's wrong in society instead of, you know, talking about corpses and blood and horror.
Yeah.
Connect it to what's happening.
Yeah.
It's such an obvious thing. And it was 1970 in Paranoid that Black Sabbath started off what I would say is a movement that should have developed, and that was politically conscious metal.
Yeah, and they were great at it. And you know, War Pigs is one of the best protest songs ever. And I, you know, I mean, I love their music so much. And it was unusual for that genre to take on those kind of things. Now let's talk a little bit about James Brown and Curtis Mayfield, because obviously a lot of the politically conscious music of the 60s involved race and what was happening. And you know, and nobody, like, I mean, James Brown and Curtis Mayfield were right at the top of that of that movement of you know, making statements about what was going on in the country being concerned with race. And so talk a little bit about that chapter with James Brown and Curtis Mayfield.
Yeah, I give it the title "Say It Loud, We're Blocked But Proud," because both James Brown and Curtis Mayfield not only found that their race was being denied rights and were blocked that way, but James Brown and Curtis Mayfield had to find ways to do politically conscious music despite the fact that their labels were worried about it.
Mm.
And by the way, there's 15 photos in this book, and I love the image of James Brown, who does a surprise appearance in Florida, and he's like waving to this crowd of kids who are screaming, and he's standing up in a car, standing through the sunroof of it, waving. It's just an amazing shot. But James Brown, I don't know how many of your WGN listeners know this, he was the first person, not Stevie Wonder, James Brown was the first person who tried to get a national holiday for Martin Luther King.
Mm.
And he went, and by this time, you know, he's Say It Loud, We're Black and Proud was an incredible anthem for a whole, you know, nation of black people.
Right, absolutely.
I mean, it was huge.
Yes.
So Nixon realized, wow, James Brown wants to meet me, so I will have him come out to the White House and listen to him, and I'll have a photo op, and citizens will see that, look, here I am with soul brother number one,
yeah.
And maybe I'll get some of the black vote. But he was playing James Brown.
Mm-hmm.
In no way did he help him try and get that national holiday.
Yeah, yeah.
And James Brown, in a very fascinating way in Music is Power, destroyed himself, not only because of drugs and all that other stuff, which is a legitimate thing, but also because he wanted to bring together a whole nation. And there was such polarization during the Vietnam War that if you were a Democrat, you didn't want to see James Brown hanging out with Richard Nixon. Right. You didn't want to see James Brown saying that Strom Thurmond of South Carolina was his friend. And it really hurt him, and he started seeing his whole career start to come apart because of that.
Fascinating stuff. Brad, hang on, okay?
Yeah.
Brad Schreiber is with us. He's the author of a terrific book about politically conscious music and the history of it. It's called Music is Power, Popular Songs, Social Justice, and the Will to Change. Really terrific book. We'll talk more with Brad right after we break here on 720 WGN. $19.89, a number, another summer. Sound of the Funky Drummer. Sorry. I kind of like Public Enemy, just a little bit. Great artists, and they're featured in the book Music is Power. Nick DiGilio here. Brad Schreiber is our guest. And the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. And after 12, we'll be joined by Margaret Hicks, who runs Chicago Elevated Walking Tours. We have some fun talking with her. She hasn't been on the show in a while, so it'll be great to catch up. But let's get Brad Schreiber back on. Brad, welcome back.
Yeah, we didn't get to Chicago's own Curtis Mayfield, I think.
No, let's talk about Curtis Mayfield for sure. Please do, because you know we can't. We're in Chicago. We have to talk about Curtis.
You absolutely do. Well, this quick story. You know, Curtis Mayfield and the Impressions were stood up for an audition at Chess Records. So I love these guys. They just went, hey, look, VJ Records is across the street. You know, and through a snowstorm, they cross the street, they go up, they demand to see the A&R man, and they sing a cappella right there for him. And that's how they started off.
That's amazing.
But of course, Curtis, like James Brown, was about self-improvement. He had five different record labels that he founded. And also, you know, Superfly, he invested the songs in the soundtrack to Superfly with real humanity.
Yeah.
You know, blaxploitation movies were very violent, and there was a lot of stereotyping. And the beauty of Curtis Mayfield is he made those people come alive and show what they had been born into and what they were stuck in. And he was a man of great compassion, and it showed in his songwriting.
Yeah, no question about it. Now, you know, similarly, you have, you know, you also have a chapter with Marvin Gaye and the Temptations.
Mm-hmm.
Marvin Gaye, one of the most, I think, important political artists in the history of music.
Yeah, people said that Gaye had it all because he could belt out a song, he could sing gospel, he could sing a love song, he could do anything. And I'm sure your listeners must know that he had to fight Berry Gordy to do what's going on. And one of the first pop songs, really, to make any statement whatsoever about the destruction of the ecology.
Yeah.
And literally, you know, Berry Gordy was threatened with having Gaye, like, leave the label. He said, okay, you can do it, but you've got to do it in like, he gave him, like, I think 2 weeks to record the whole album.
Yeah.
It was insane. And he accomplished it, and it was just magnificent.
Yeah, and it's a legendary record. And then The Temptations, Ball of Confusion, so many other songs that they were making statements, and also being really funky on top of it.
Yeah, that for me, when I was a young man, Ball of Confusion with the Temptations was a huge song. I went to a primarily black middle school in Northern California, and I can remember the kids with their radios, and everybody, it bonded together, black and white kids, the music that was being played every day.
Yeah.
And that of course, is a case of a producer, Norman Whitfield, going, wow, psychedelic soul, let's cash in on this, let's make some money.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't about his commitment to change, but it was about his recognizing this is what's happening in music.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were some fantastic songs written for the Temps because of it.
Yeah, no question about it. The book is called Music is Power, Popular Songs, Social Justice, and the Will to Change. Barry Schreiber is the author. We've got a caller on the line, and it's Doc. Doc, welcome to the show, Doc.
Hey, Nick. Hey, it's really interesting, Brad. Hey, I got a couple of comment and a question about country music. I collect older and classic country, and I think part of the evolution is, you know, there was a lot of pro-American World War II country music, and I think it's because a lot of guys served. Plus, we were attacked by a direct enemy who attacked us, smashed us. In today's world, we're not sure who our enemies are. We intervene in other people's business. And I wanted to just talk about one particular song, Charlie Daniels, I think it's from 2011, If You Won't Let Them Win, Bring Them Home, because that's a very patriotic guy, but I think he respectfully shows some civility and challenges authority.
Yeah.
That's a good point. Also, Merle Haggard, who clearly was a very conservative, changed his mind when the Dixie Chicks were attacked for, you know, criticizing George W. Bush's war in Iraq.
Right.
And Merle Haggard said, you know, I don't know anything about the Dixie Chicks, but all I know is they have a right to express their opinion. Because, of course, radio stations attack them, country fans attack them, and the government attack them. So that's a chapter in Music is Power, the Dixie Chicks went through.
That was an amazing amazing time period to see the Dixie Chicks become, because they were like sort of like country pop, nice music, good, and all of a sudden they're in the middle of this firestorm of politics and you know, with the government uprising and the cover of the Rolling Stone, where they had all the words written on them.
Entertainment Weekly,
Nick. Right? Yeah, and I remember that there was a very specific and strong period of time right there for them.
Okie from Muskogee, We Don't Burn No Glory Down at the Courthouse, and Fight Inside of Me.
Yeah. All right, Doc. Thanks, man.
All right, man.
Take care.
That's a really good point that he made, you know, and there are those exceptions. I recommend that if you haven't seen it, you recommend to your listeners, Shut Up and Sing, the documentary that Barbara Kopple made, 2-time Oscar winner. And I loved interviewing her, and she gave me such great insight, which I put into the book about, you know, they had death threats during their tour.
Yeah.
And then it prompted a song called Not Ready to Make Nice, which talked about how they were treated.
Yeah, it's a great. By the way, I'm glad you mentioned that documentary, Brad, because it's terrific. It is a really, really terrific documentary. Listen,
Barbara's phenomenal.
We're about out of time, but I want to make sure that people know that we barely scratched the surface on the different types of genres and artists that are in here, from Frank Zappa to Peter Gabriel, Bob Marley, Grandmaster Flash, Public Enemy, N.W.A., Green Day, and many, 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 many more. I got to tell you, congratulations, Brad. This is a terrific book.
Oh, I really appreciate you and Tom and all your WGN listeners, and it's a real pleasure to put this book out, especially now.
Yeah. Okay, Brad, thank you so much.
Thanks again, Nick.
All right, take care. Brad Schreiber, everybody. The book is called Music is Power, Popular Songs, Social Justice, and the Will to Change.